Good afternoon. The House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development will come to order. We're hoping for a couple more members to make their way in, but we have an agenda to get through, so we'll get started. Let's start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 130.
Senate Bill 130 adds green, yellow, and red bicycle signals to a list of traffic control devices.
Thank you. And we're going to hear from Paul Mather in the department first, please. You have visual aids again. Excellent. Are they animated like last time?
Of course.
Fabulous.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT, here to speak about Senate Bill 130. Senate Bill 130 is on bicycle signals and has a dash one amendments. I'm going to speak to both of those separately, so don't get too distracted with the graphic yet. That's on the amendment piece. I want to talk about the bicycle signals first. If you turn to my testimony that's being passed out, rather than an animated visual, I have a photograph there that I think that illustrates the issue with the bicycles. Senate Bill 130 really puts into statute a practice that is currently at five locations at signals within the city of Portland. As you know, as we see additional bicycle traffic at congestion intersections, we need to have some tools to better facilitate traffic through those intersections. And what this bill does is allow for, not prescribe, but allow for jurisdictions to put in bicycle signals to allow bicycles to have their own phase in the signal. This will be appropriate only at a specific limited intersections. These intersections will need to be fairly complicated intersections with a number of pedestrian movements, vehicle movements, turning movements that will warrant to have a specific phase for bicycles. The picture that I have in front of you is on MLK near the Rose Garden, and I think those familiar with that area will recognize that is an area that's with complicated intersections, also with a high volume of bicycle activity at that intersection. So what the bill does is just put in statute what's been in practice at five intersections within the city of Portland. There's one being planned in the city of Ashland, planned for this summer. Currently, there aren't any plans in the state highway system to put these in, but they would be something that would be a tool available for local jurisdictions, the state, to put in at various intersections. So, again, relatively straightforward, just putting into statute the ability to use those bicycle signals and keep intersections moving safely and efficiently that has bicycle volumes. What I've got in the dash one amendments. The dash one amendments have to do with flashing yellow arrows for left turn signals. It's something that's relatively new in Oregon, where we're using flashing yellow lights to better utilize our signalized timing and intersections efficiently. I think we've all been frustrated at times to pull up in a left turn lane, sit at a red light, and there is no car in sight in the opposing lane, and you clearly could move forward safely. What the flashing yellow arrow does is allow you in those circumstances, yielding to that oncoming traffic, to move forward. The amendments don't deal with that specific aspect. It deals with specifically to allowing you to enter the intersection on that flashing yellow and then complete your turn later on. And if you look at the graphic that I provided for you, that white car that's proceeding right there is an example of that. That white car has entered into the intersection on a flashing yellow and then proceeded to make their turn they're able to from oncoming traffic. Right now, there's ambiguity in the law as to whether you have to wait at the stop bar or whether you can enter the intersection. What the dash one amendments do is clearly allow you in a flashing yellow situation to enter the intersection, yield to oncoming traffic, and then to proceed on to make your turn. So with that, on both those two, I'll take questions.
Great, thanks. And I'll take the opportunity just to clarify that I asked whether the flashing yellow arrow question could be addressed in this bill. I have a constituent whose son encountered this in his driving test, and it looks like an opportunity to clarify a needed ambiguity. So the source is somewhat me. Let's also ask Peter Kunz to come forward from the City of Portland, and if you wanted to address the bike signals as well, and then we can take questions from both of you.
Sure. Co-Chairs Benson, Reed, members of the committee, thank you for your opportunity to appear before you this afternoon to testify related to Senate Bill 130. For the record, I am Peter Kunz, Signals and Streetlight Manager for the City of Portland's Bureau of Transportation. Now, the City supports the Oregon Transportation Commission's submission of State Bill 130 and values the endorsement of the Senate. In Portland, we have applied these signals at select locations, as Paul suggested. We feel that in adding green, amber, and red to bicycle traffic control devices will codify a technique that we've used to remove confusion and to improve the safety of our streets. We've had the opportunity to provide this exclusive display. Interstate in Oregon is a great example of that, where without that device, we wouldn't have the opportunity to safely move cyclists through that intersection. We've used signal heads now at a variety of locations where we want to reduce conflict or provide an opportunity for bicyclists to avoid dangerous locations. This often occurs at select locations throughout the city. We have five of them, moving towards six, and we're looking at potential other locations where we may apply this in the future. New signal is intuitive, unambiguous, and distinct from pedestrian displays. Providing these different displays allows us better opportunity to manage the intersection and the time of each movement. The need for additional devices to communicate to motorists and cyclists is clear. We have, again, used these at various locations, and there are other cities throughout the region that are looking into these. The Portland Bureau of Transportation will partner in any way necessary to advance the clear communication with our system users about how to effectively and safely share the road.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm looking at the picture you have here. I'm sure you have it over there. And it makes sense to me, but I'm just thinking back. It's been a while since I've taken a driving test. But it's legal to make a right-hand turn on a red light onto a one-way, correct? So you have a one-way here. You have the bike lane. So this is one more. There's three lights on that signal. This would be essentially a fourth light that the driver would be responsible for looking at before proceeding. So, or if a driver made that right-hand turn and a bicyclist came and hit him, who would be at fault there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, actually, as a motorist, you wouldn't need to watch that signal, the bicycle signal. You just need to pay attention to the signal in your lane to direct you what to do. Just as pedestrians go on pedestrian signals now, bicycles would go on their signal. As you'll notice also in the picture, there is a lighted sign that says no turn on red. So as those cyclists, in this case, get their signal green to go forward, that no turn on red light lights up. And just need to, again, follow the signals that's in front of you as a driver and the directions with that no turn on red.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So why can't bicyclists just follow the traffic signals that are up there right now?
In this case, what we would like to do is essentially codify what we've done and provide that opportunity for clear communication. On our neighborhood greenways, we're providing just pedestrian displays. What we'd like to do with the bicycle signal is have that opportunity to reduce the amount of delay to motorists by providing less time for the overall crossing. Today, we have to provide enough time for a walk and a flash don't walk at an intersection where a bicycle may be crossing. Having a bicycle display allows us to shorten that time. If we don't have a presence of a pedestrian, the bicycle takes a lot less time to cross the intersection. So having this separate display gives us an opportunity to reduce the delay to all users at the intersections.
Hello?
I guess just a comment, really, if you'll allow it.
Please.
our traffic signals are just based so much on convention and so much on just the universal understanding of what everything means. In Canada, they have a blinking green light, which always throws me off completely, you know, when I get there. This just seems like a really confusing addition to something that everyone's been used to for decades. I don't see the usefulness of this, and I see it just creating a lot more confusion than it's meant to clear up. So that's my two cents.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to figure out exactly how or what or if there is any coordination between the bicycle light on the one hand and the traffic lights on the other, or is it just something? I think you said there's an additional phase. Can you explain what that meant?
Yeah, excellent question. The bicycle signal is integrated into the existing traffic controller unit there, so it is essentially separating the movement of the bicycle from that right turn movement. So we're taking just a bit of time there to clearly communicate to the cyclists that they have the opportunity to go through the intersection, which is a conflicting movement to the right turn at this location.
Follow up. Just looking at this photograph, it looks as though people could turn right because there is the yellow light, but they would have to watch out for the folks on the bicycles. Is that what this picture is showing us?
Yes, we're allowing a clearance interval between those two movements that safely separates the bicycles from the vehicles at that location.
Well, I don't see the interval is my point. It looks to me as though I could turn right if I was in a car. And it looks to me like the light for the bicycles is green. So where's the interval?
Once the bicycle has a green light, it goes to yellow and then red for that bicycle movement. Following a brief red interval for the bicycle signal, we have the green come up for the right turn arrow.
Yeah, it's just in this photograph, it shows a yellow arrow to the right. At the same time, there's a green bicycle light.
That may be an issue with the printer. It looks to me, like that's the top light, so maybe it's supposed to be red.
It's a red light.
It's a red light.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Right. It's just a red light. And I hope I'm not colorblind. This could explain a lot.
It's yellow to me.
maybe just a printer. Yeah.
That answers that question. Let follow up, please. If the additional time that the people driving the automobiles now have to wait, is there any? Since we've added an interval, does that mean all the cars get to wait? Why this light changes, and does it? Why this light? I mean the bicycle light. Goes through the sequence.
At this location, because we've changed the lane configurations, we have two dual rights at this location. We've actually added capacity to the right turn. So we have equalized the delay for the throughs and the right turns at that location. And overall, from a system perspective, we feel it's still operating within our standards for delay at the intersection.
Well, right, but the question was, do the folks in general, not necessarily at this intersection, are the folks in the automobiles going to have to wait longer now that we have the bicycle signals in place?
It's a question that I could have to get back to you on. I think the overall delay may be about the same with either configuration. I was not involved in the analysis of this particular location. This is actually brought on by a project that's happening on this location with the streetcar. So it's a project that I'd have to go back and get the data for that.
And wouldn't it be true that the answer to that question probably varies considerably based on the specific location and whether, like in this case, you've described adding a second right turn lane, and maybe there's an advantage if all the bikes go through in mass rather than a person in a car having to wait occasionally for to stop and slow. And I bet it varies. Am I right in that?
It does. It varies considerably. In some of our locations, we're seeing a benefit because you're not having to look for that bicyclist that's coming up from behind you. Previously, we had the bicycle in between the two lanes that had the option to turn right. And here, we're removing that need to yield to cyclists by just controlling the time that we're providing at the intersection for cyclists and motorists alike.
Just a couple more. Yep. Thank you. Are these lights operated by the same button that the pedestrian would push, or are they operating all the time?
They are actuated, so they are. We have a push button at this particular location. The push button is something that we don't need to use. We can use a regular detector like we use for other vehicles in the bike lane, so we can distinguish between vehicles and bicycles.
Does the bicycle one have a lower threshold to recognize the bike?
It does. There's a higher sensitivity associated with it, and actually there's new products on the market that identify whether it's a bike or a vehicle, so it can only detect if a bicycle runs over it as opposed to a vehicle.
Thank you. Your point then about this taking less time for the bicycles to get across than would have been the case had the cyclist used a pedestrian light. Was that the point you were making earlier? In other words, but for the bicycle light, folks on bicycles would maybe hit the button for the pedestrian and the automobile drivers would have to wait longer. Was that your point earlier?
That's exactly right. If in a normal situation, we have to provide for the normal walking speed, which is 3.5 feet per second. Obviously, bicycling speed is a lot higher. So the amount of time that's necessary for that particular movement is considerably less with a bicycle display.
And how much less?
At this intersection, I'll do some quick math. The time, it's about a 70-foot crossing. So the flashing don't walk time, the time that someone would be delayed at this intersection is probably 20 seconds. At this location, the bicycle time, the green time, can be as low as 8 seconds. So we're saving 12 seconds at the intersection every time that the bicycle is activated there.
And I just had two more questions.
Go ahead.
The first is, what do these things cost the jurisdiction to install? And the second is, do the cyclists know that they have to follow these lights and not the regular traffic lights?
Great questions. The first question on the cost, the additional bicycle signal head runs on the order of about $1,000 to purchase the equipment and install. Today we are just using the exact same equipment they would use for a regular vehicle signal head. We're just changing the lens so that it shows the stencil of the bicycle in that lens. And that's been our experience throughout the five or six that we have available to us right now, is we're putting them at existing signals, so we're not building them separate from any other project. We're just putting the signal head up where we have a signal today. A traditional traffic signal at this location would be about $150,000. So we're just adding the bicycle head in addition, so very low cost. The other question was,
How do we know that the bicyclists are going to follow these new lights and not the old regular traffic lights?
We did some additional testing at Interstate in Oregon, our first location, and noted that the compliance at the onset was on the order of 80%. And what we've seen is that previously the compliance was very low, much less than 50%. Of having a cyclist make a two-stage crossing. What we've seen as people have been more familiar with these, now this has been operating, some of our earliest bicycle signals have been there for 6 years now, and so what we're seeing is a near 98% compliance at the interstate in Oregon. But we are doing some tests with Portland State right now to do some research to further understand the compliance at these intersections and how bicycle signals are being adhered to.
Just a comment. Obviously, we have to know which they're supposed to follow if we were driving a car, so we could know, we could make the appropriate assumptions. So those riding bicycles would have to be told they can't do what they used to and must follow. But I don't think this bill says that. At least I haven't read it that way. But I'm just wondering if this bill, I hate to say, sends the signal to the bicyclists that they can do both. That would be unfortunate.
My reading of the bill was that it was fairly clear that someone on a bicycle would adhere to the green, yellow, and red indications. So I think this does help in the interpretation of the rule to communicate what the expectation is to cyclists.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's right or not, to be honest with you, in my reading of it, but it might be worth staring at more closely, discussing later.
I think in our discussions that was the original intent of the rulemaking.
Thank you.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bence's final question and comments are along the lines of what I wanted to mention. I get concerned about compliance with traffic signals or compliance with law. It seems like we have a generation or two of bicyclists who somehow have missed learning about rules of the road and signaling. I drive in a part of town in Eugene, which is very heavy use by bicyclists. I bicycle in a different part of town, closer to where I live, but sometimes I bicycle in that part of town also. And it's pretty scary when you're a driver and you're trying to do the right thing. And one of the things you mentioned is you won't any longer have to worry about someone coming up from behind you. And I'm concerned that without a much more aggressive and systematic way of helping bicyclists understand how to coexist with cars and vice versa, that we'll see more conflicts before we start seeing fewer. Because I think maybe now bicyclists will be zooming through, they'll just be zooming through on the right instead of between two lanes. And as a driver, I'm not going to trust counting on a signal that says red for a bicyclist. I will feel like I still need to stop and look in case someone is zooming up on the right, because in Eugene, my experience is that is what happens. There's also, in this one part of town I use, bicyclists going the wrong way on one-way streets and on both sides of the road. So it's very hard to drive safely, especially at night, with a bicycle that doesn't have a light, or the bicyclist doesn't have a light on their person, you know, on the head or shoulders somewhere. So I guess this is all just a means of saying I'm not necessarily opposed to this new kind of signalization. I just want us to be mindful that I think all of us need to figure out how to be more proactive in helping drivers and bicyclists both understand how to share the road. It's about sharing the road, and I don't think we're as good at it as we should be.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davidson, you'll notice in my written testimony that we do acknowledge that with this change there will be some outreach that we'll need to do, some education we'll need to do. We plan on working with the Oregon Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee, which is appointed by the governor, and use them to help us advise on how to get the information out, the training out in an appropriate way.
I have a question about the bill specifically that is probably very simple and just we're not being very quick on it. In the second or the last sentence of Section 1, Subsection 3, our able community administrators helped me imagine a scenario that might explain this, but I want to see if we've got it right. The second sentence, the bicyclist shall yield the right-of-way to other vehicles within the intersection at the time the green bicycle signal is shown. Can you explain what that means, please? I'm having a hard time imagining if the light is green, is it someone who's proceeding to use where we are right now, where the orange car was going, and someone is turning or is entering from the right and making a right turn, or maybe we need an animation for this.
Go ahead, Coach Reed. We it's essentially mimicking the existing rule related to green signals. What we're intending with that language is to ensure that upon receiving a green indication that you still must yield the right of way if there is someone passing through the intersection or within the intersection on the onset of green. So it still puts the onus on the user of the facility not to expect that they can enter in the intersection at the first tenth of a second of the green.
I think I was reading something more into it. It's essentially look and make sure there isn't someone else who's dealing with a yellow they weren't expecting. Or that sort of thing. Okay, thank you very much. Other questions for this group? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This kind of leads into a little bit about, and it's not too much about the bill, but the comments that Representative Nathanson was hitting and Representative Bentz, because it is becoming an issue with bicyclists, even out where I live in County, where we'll have two bicyclists riding abreast, and you have cars trying to get by on rural roads, and they sit and have their conversations and set up dangerous situations for people driving. I'm just wondering, is there anything happening on the enforcement front for bicycles that aren't obeying the traffic laws? Because we're running into situations where some bicyclist, and it only takes a few to create a bad name for the whole industry, and you get those few that are doing the bad things. If we start enforcing some of the laws or writing tickets for some of it, and I don't know if there's anything we can do to help with that, but they don't have licenses, they don't have any way, so it's kind of tough for police to do anything with them. But if there's anything we could do to help out so police could enforce things to make the roads safer for everyone, I would like input from the department on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, as you know, as a cyclist and a driver myself, I'm frustrated with that same situation of the drivers that are disrespectful, I think, to other users of the roadway. I'm not aware of anything that we're doing within the department on that specific issue. I'm not sure I would characterize myself as the expert on that to know. So I can do some research and see if there is anything that we're doing. But I do note your comment, and again, as a driver and a cyclist, that is a frustrating situation.
Mr. Chair, may I add to that?
Please do.
Representative Widener, the Bureau of Transportation has been very aggressive in enforcement, and we do respond to complaints of stop sign violations. That's the most regular complaint that we get. In fact, my father, as a cyclist, got a ticket for running a stop sign. I hear that as a complaint from cyclists, but I see it as the duty of enforcing the law, and helps to reinforce not only at stop signs but also at bicycle signals. So at the bicycle signal that we put in place, we had police out there at the onset of the turn on of the signal, and there was warnings for the first week for both cyclists and vehicles alike. So we've been very active, and when we introduce something new, to get the word out and to enforce the display, because I share Representative Nathanson's concerns about if we aren't educating as a part of these new devices, we will have less willingness to innovate in the future. And we feel it's important to keeping our citizens moving, to have that ability to try things and to experiment with new things that will really make our transportation system more effective.
Thank you very much. Before we let these experts escape, are there any questions about the Dash 1 amendments? Right, the animation. Okay, thank you very much. Please don't go away, because we may uncover some additional questions for you. A few other people who would like to be heard on the bill: Paul McCain, not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Owen Sinclair, and Jonathan Manton. I'll let you gentlemen decide who would like to go first.
Yes, go ahead.
You sure?
Okay.
All right. Co-Chair Reed and Co-Chair Bentz, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me this opportunity to lend my voice in support of Senate Bill 130 today. My name is Paul McKean, and I'm a senior right across the street at Willamette University, and my family and I have lived outside of Portland for almost my whole life. In a time when our government faces contentious debates about budget deficits and the economy, it is nice to be able to speak today about a bill that just seems like a matter of common sense to me. I support this bill as a native Oregonian and the son of an avid biker. You've heard the arguments in favor of Senate Bill 130. This bill does not have any fiscal impact on our already strained state budget. It does not mandate the creation of any new signals or construction projects. To me, it just seems like a legislative fix, which would make it easier for cities to make intersections and road crossings safer for both bikers and drivers, and would provide clearer rules that would help, as Rep. Nathanson said earlier, bikes to coexist with cars. Some of my favorite memories growing up was going on bike rides with my dad. He always took me out for rides around town when I was a little kid, and he has always taught me to respect the rules of the road. And these days, with a tight state budget, we hear a lot of people calling for smarter government. Well, Senate Bill 130 seems to me like a pretty smart bill. I hope that you will consider supporting this bill so that bikers like my dad can ride safer on the streets of Portland and around Oregon. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair and representatives, members of the committee, thank you for having me today, allowing me to speak. I'm also a student over at Willamette University. I'm a sophomore.
And if you could start with your name for our record, that would
be helpful. Oh, yes. My name is Owen Sinclair.
Thanks.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No problem.
And I'm also here in support of this bill, being a biker in Oregon and having friends who live in Portland, which I know is one of the heaviest areas for bike and traffic coexistence in our state, although certainly, as Representative Nathanson was saying, you know, in other areas such as Eugene and even West Salem, where I live with my parents. I was at dinner the other day with a friend of mine who lives in Portland. She was saying that it's I was telling her about this bill that I was coming to testify about. It's a two-pronged problem for her, both as a motorist, not knowing whether bicyclists are going to shoot out from roads randomly running stop signs and red lights, and as a bicyclist in Portland, not knowing exactly how to mitigate traffic signals, which, while they're there, while it may say red or green, they're not directed towards bicyclists, they're directed towards motorists. I see that this bill is a positive step, you know, with certain mitigating factors like enforcement, you know, certainly to be worked out, towards giving bicyclists a more clear sense of their position on the road. I know that since the instigation of bicycle lanes on roads, I, as a driver, have started becoming more aware of whether or not bicycles are coming up beside me. I feel that bicycle signal is another step for me to maybe still look around but not spend as much time worrying whether a bicyclist is going to run the red light. Not only that, but this sort of legislation at the state level allows local jurisdictions to implement their own laws, at least provide a framework for it, and not, you know, also kind of help Oregon lead the way to this sort of legislation at the federal level. So, thank you very much.
Mr. Manton, and then see if there are any questions.
Great. Co-Chairs Benson Reed, members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Manton, and I'm testifying today on behalf of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance in support of Senate Bill 130. And much of our agenda, if we to use the word agenda, but the things that we're supporting and working on this session are primarily efforts to reduce conflict, to help our roads be safe for all users. And what we found is when these signals have been in place, that has been the result exactly. And so we think that because this will help reduce conflicts and increase safety of the roads, that we strongly support it. And I just want to kind of note that with some of the comments that have been made, certainly share and agree with those, that it doesn't do any of us any good when we have cyclists or anyone else you know, breaking traffic laws. And so to the extent that we can help with educating the public and find ways to work together to reduce infractions, then we're certainly more than happy to do so. And so just thank you for your time. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Not a one. Okay. Thanks for making the long trip across the street. I was a student at Willamette, so I appreciate you guys being here as well.
Thanks
very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That completes the list of people who have signed up to testify on Senate Bill 130. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on this bill? I don't see anyone. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 130. And I think it probably does not make sense to send the bill out today, given some of the discussion. But I would be interested and the possibility of adopting the Dash 1 amendment so we could consider that going forward. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 130 for that purpose. Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, I move that he adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 130 dated 4/26/11.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 130 dated April 26, 2011. Is there a discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Byer.
Thank you. The City of Springfield has been installing a lot of these flashing yellow lights and arrows, and they're great. I mean, it really is a big improvement over the standard lights that we've had in the past, so I'm all for it.
Great. Thank you. Other discussion? Representative Nathans.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if you know, I was just musing with the previous panel, hearing that some of these might be self-activated just by the sensor strips in the pavement. Seems like the weight of a bicycle plus a small child could actually be less than some very large dogs that sometimes you see on a sidewalk or on the side of a roadway. I'm just wondering, what the weight is going to be required to trip it. It's just one of those interesting things to think about.
We can certainly have someone follow up on that. I'm not sure that's especially relevant to the Dash 1 amendments.
It's not, and it's not going to change my vote on the day that we vote.
Okay.
But I'd like to hear a little bit about that.
I imagine that there's some interest in following up with you. Andy, some nodding, so I think they'll pass along some information. Is there further discussion of the motion? I don't see any. Is there any objection to the motion? I don't see any. Dash 1 amendments are adopted, and close the work session on Senate Bill 130, and likely come back to it again soon. Next up on the agenda, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 132. Zach.
Senate Bill 132 removes the bond requirement for four hire carriers that offer to collect on delivery service.
Thank you. Amy Joyce, Bob Russell.
Co-chairs Reed and Benz, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. And the department is bringing to you Senate Bill 132 today, which is really quite a simple bill. It would simply remove a bond requirement that exists in the law for a very small group of trucking carriers, because that bond requirement, we have recently learned, is preempted by federal law. A small portion of Oregon's trucking industry offers collect-on-delivery, or COD, service by which they pick up goods from a shipper. They deliver it to its destination, pick up an amount of money to pay that invoice, and then take that money back to the shipper. They offer that service. Very few folks do it. But the law requires that if you do provide that service, you have to have a bond on file with the state. There are only today 27 carriers in Oregon who have that bond of $10,000, and our records reflect that no one has ever had to collect on that bond. Be that as it may, within the last year or two, it came to the attention of the department that federal law preempts our requiring of that bond. And on advice of Department of Justice, the department stopped requiring that bond because of the federal preemption. So we come to you today asking that you simply remove that provision from the law. And that is simply what SB 132 does.
Russell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. I'm just here to say that we support Senate Bill 132, and Amy and I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
So one obvious question, I imagine there are others, had something changed in the federal law that when this was initially enacted it was okay, and then the feds changed something that brought us out of compliance?
Cherry, the federal law changed in 1994, but the interpretation of the department was that this portion of Oregon's trucking regulation was not one of those things that significantly changed trucking regulation in 1994. However, the department received a contact from a national law firm indicating that they believed that, in fact, it was preempted. Oregon Department of Justice checked that out, and after some back and forth and legal analysis, agreed that in fact this provision was preempted and under that 1994 provision of the law.
What can you tell us about how many people or companies do this and how they might be affected?
Mr. Chair, 27 carriers in Oregon today carry this bond. They will be affected in that they will no longer need to carry that bond, so it's a small cost savings to each of them. And again, in the records of the department, no one has ever had to collect on this bond. So people who do this are doing what they're supposed to do. People aren't getting stiffed, for lack of a better term. No one's having to collect on the bond, so its lack of being in place doesn't seem to be any kind of lack of consumer benefit by repealing this.
So the last question for me, is there any, are there other measures of protection if and when this is removed that would remain in place?
Chair Reed, Mr. Russell may be able to better answer this, but my reaction would be that certainly any civil remedies exist for anyone who is not given the value for which they have paid.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would totally agree with that answer, that there are civil remedies that are available. And I would also suggest that the need for this service has largely been replaced by the credit card. And that's, you know, we really don't do this anymore. We used to do it all the time when people didn't have credit cards, but now when you pay for your purchases that you order by credit card, the COD service is no longer necessary.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any courier services that do this collect on delivery service?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, I believe that some of the carriers still have provisions in their tariffs where they can do this. But I don't believe that the demand for the service is there primarily because if the customer uses a credit card, the funds are available to the seller of the goods virtually instantaneously. If they were to use a provision like this, then they have to wait for the goods to be transported and then for the trucking company or the motor carrier to transmit the funds back to the seller of the goods. So from a time perspective, I don't believe that in today's world that this is a valuable service. So where we may still have the provision to provide it, I don't believe that there's any demand for it.
Other questions? Don't see any. Oh. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Forgive if you touched on this. Other states, what do we know about other states? Was that the question that just got asked? Didn't get asked yet. Good. I'm not feeling well. I'll try not to infect you. But, what do we know about other states, the requirements that happen elsewhere?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, the preemption of state law by the federal law that was passed in 1994 that Ms. Joyce referred to in her earlier testimony preempted these types of provisions in all states. Mm-hmm. So no state is allowed to continue to promulgate this type of regulation.
Cool. Thanks. Representative Benz?
I'm just tempted to comment on how long it took us to figure this out. 1994.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair.
And it wasn't us, Mr. Chair, that figured
right.
it out. We heard that it was a law firm who figured it out.
Yeah, I suspect that there's a number of things in right. our state statutes that are no longer necessary.
That's comforting.
Until someone points it out. We don't often do something about it, but in this case, I really think that in 1994, the service wasn't even being provided back then, and we didn't think about it until somebody brought it to the department's attention.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Amy, Bob, just real quick, I want to know how you feel knowing that Representative Smith doesn't want to infect you, but he doesn't mind infecting me whatsoever with his letter.
That question answers itself.
All kinds of jokes to be made about it.
I'll take that as a rhetorical question.
Yes, good choice. Good choice. Okay, that completes the list of people who want to talk about this scintillating bill. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on Senate Bill 132? I don't see any. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 132. Committee, are we ready? Open a work session on Senate Bill 132. Representative Benz.
Move Senate Bill 132 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Benz has moved Senate Bill 132 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Good bill should pass.
Thank you. Any objection to the motion? I don't see any. Motion carries. Senate Bill 132 heads to the floor with the due-pass recommendation. Representative Widener, would you like to carry?
Oh, I'd love carrying these bills.
I suspected. Representative Widener will carry.
I can do the beat test.
Thank you, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 132 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 147. Zach.
Senate Bill 147 modifies descriptions of pilotage grounds.
A very similar, perhaps a similar bill. Tom Markgraf, Steve Woods, and Gary Lewin, I think. Did I get it right? The N was what was tripping me up. At, did I get it right?
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
I'll let you decide who goes first, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Tom Markgraf, and I am the Vice Chair of the Board of Maritime Pilots. Our mission is to provide safe, effective, and competent piloted services on all the piloted grounds in the state of Oregon. We license and regulate all the pilots to provide piloted services on the Aquinnah, the Coos Bay, the Columbia Bar, and the Columbia River. I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 147, which has the support of all the stakeholders, including the Columbia River steamship operators, the River Bar pilots, the Columbia River pilots, and the Coos Bay Bar pilots. I am not aware of any opposition. Our current statutory description, which has been in place since 1957 at least, contains inadequate descriptions of our grounds, and they're vague and ambiguous. For example, the Columbia River Bar pilotage ground is currently defined as extending from the uppermost dock or wharf of the pilot of the Port of Astoria or to Napton to the open sea in at least 30 fathoms of water. This bill addresses this problem by defining the pilotage grounds in longitudes and latitudes, so there can be no question of where a vessel needs to have a pilot on board. The second thing that this bill does is vessels entering or leaving the Columbia River pilotage grounds travel through a zone outside the boundary that can create traffic management issues and unsafe conditions without appropriate communications between the pilots and the vessels. This bill addresses the problem by establishing a precautionary zone outside the Columbia River Bar for vessels intending to enter or leave the pilotage grounds, and it requires them to communicate with the pilotage under instructions from the licensee for that grounds. It's pretty simple. It's a matter of enhancing communication for the vessels coming or going, and it's a matter of identifying exactly where the pilotage grounds are. It's kind of housekeeping.
Thank you. I appreciate the description. Please go ahead.
My name is Captain Steve Woods. I'm the Vice President to the Columbia River Pilots, and I'm testing on behalf of our organization. And the Columbia River Pilots support the passage of Senate Bill 147. Current law defining the boundaries of pilotage waters uses are out of date, and questionable reference points to define the grounds. Senate Bill 147 establishes the reference points based on easily definable and measurable latitude and longitude positions. Under Senate Bill 147, any competent mariner can easily determine the pilot ground boundaries, and we urge the committee to support the bill's passage. And on a second note, I'm also a Coos Bay and Aquinnah Bay state licensed pilot, and the impetus that started the 147 bill was the new CARISA. And the lack of a determining area that we could have told that captain, you will not come inside this area and you will not anchor. And part of that was specifically the fact that our pilotage grounds go from the head of navigation in Coos Bay out to 30 fathoms. Well, is that 30 fathoms straight on that entrance departure lane, or is it 40 miles up the coast or whatever? And so the goal was to get the grounds delineated with latitudes and longitudes as they are now. So that's all I have.
Thank you very much, particularly for the explanation about the new caress of the specific sort of story certainly helped me. Appreciate it. Mr. Lewis.
Co-chairs and respected committee members, I'm Captain Gary Lewin from the Columbia River Bar Pilots, and I'm the administrative pilot for that organization. The Bar Pilots are responsible for the safe navigation and safe passage of vessels across the notoriously dangerous Columbia River Bar and over the navigable waterway into Astoria. And I'm here to answer any questions and testify in favor of Senate Bill 147, which promotes safety, defines pilotage grounds for foreign vessels and domestic commercial vessels. The Bar Pilots' main focus, as the Board's main focus, is safety. Senate Bill 147 codifies and describes our current safe practices and eliminates any ambiguities for foreign vessels approaching the Columbia River. The bill, as Tom mentioned, removes antiquated definitions of the pilot's grounds, as well as publishing and making available to these commercial vessels approaching the river what the accepted procedures are for departing and entering a congested and potentially dangerous navigational area. The bill endorses and codifies our current practices. It's precisely what we do now. It just puts it in writing so everybody knows what the game plan is, in a standard and useful format, which is easily understood by all users of the system. So we do support Senate Bill 147, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. I have a question for Representative Smith, too. Do you know what a fathom is?
I had to look it up. I know it's a distance. Is it? No, I don't know what a fathom is. How was a fathom?
2 yards. I had to look it up. Questions down here?
I couldn't fathom an answer.
Yeah, sorry. Representative Sheehan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So nothing is changing from what you're currently doing, including the precautionary zone, though, looks like it's new?
The precautionary zone is new by definition, but it is precisely what we do. When vessels enter that area, we start by radio communications, basically tell them where to go, depending on traffic, depending on weather, depending on whether the river is flowing to the north or flowing to the south. It's a very, very dynamic area. So what this does is it does define to the incoming ships, this is our precautionary area, pay attention. And when we do talk to them, they will tend to pay more attention that way. It's more visual when they look on the chart and see the words precautionary area.
Follow up. So that doesn't require your direct supervision in the precautionary zone. It's once they break free of the precautionary zone, then it requires the bar pilot to be on board the vessel to take them in, right?
The act, as it's written, has a compulsory pilotage area, the start of one, which is precisely where it is now. It's that white area. I don't know if there were any graphics with that bill, but basically we have a precautionary area up here, and right below that is what I'll call a white area. That's where compulsory pilotage is mandated. So it doesn't change the compulsory pilotage area itself, but it does put the vessel on notice, as in other ports such as San Francisco, that this is a very dangerous area. There's lots of traffic, there's lots of issues coming up, and the pilot will start telling them what to do. By radio, we might be on the helicopter, we might be on another ship, but we'll be communicating with an inbound ship.
Okay. Another question. There's a pretty extraordinary expense with hiring a bar pilot to come and do this. Does this create any additional service level that's needed for the
No. The
vessels? This is just the same?
No.
And then, Mr. Chair, I think I appreciate all of the all the latitude and longitude. I think I'd like to see this on a map, really, before...
Basically follows the contiguous area, the 12-mile...
I'd still like to see a map. Sure. Thanks.
I can...
Copies? We'll... We'll make sure that...
I just brought it for my own reference, but you're fine with it.
We appreciate that. Thank you very much. We'll bring the bill back at a subsequent hearing so we can have time to have that distributed and make sure that... If you have time to make some copies now, I think we're going to need to have another day with the bill.
I have
anyway,
some for
so
Tuesday and Quinnaby also. If you're
willing to share, that'd be terrific. And you can leave those with our committee assistant. She can make sure that we get copies of it at a later date. Other questions? Representative Beyer.
Well, you've made a couple, because you're from Coos Bay or that area, whatever. So you've made a couple of comments about that. So is anything in this bill carry over into your area?
Yes, that the grounds for Coos Bay and Yaquina Bay were similar to the river, and the description was very vague. It was from the head of navigation out to 30 fathoms. What this does is it gives latitude and longitudes, approximately covers 4 miles north or south of the entrance, or 4 miles in total, and then out 3 miles. And it's outside of our entrance buoy about a mile. And so we can tell that ship, you know, you stay at least 2 miles out, you know, stay 2 miles outside of this zone, but at no time do you enter this zone or this area. And that'll be on their chart. They'll be able to see that. And the same thing for Yaquina Bay. And, of course, the river has a lot more traffic, and the precautionary zone goes out a lot further, and it encompasses a larger area. But it's basically so we can tell them, do not come in any closer than this area.
And I would just note that I had that, once you asked that question, I looked again at the staff measure summary, and I think it's incomplete. Our ABLE community administrator deserves no blame for that, but since it came from the Senate. But at the bottom of the first page, there's a similar description for the Coos Bay,
okay,
as well as Columbia. So I would have gone the same confusion,
yeah,
reading the staff measure summary, but it looks like the same kind of changes made to the Coos Bay description. Other questions?
Yes, Chair.
Representative Benson, then Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a follow along, and perhaps the map that you've supplied will answer the questions. The 180 feet or 30 fathoms was the old measure of the extent to which this area extended, and now we have a defined distance of miles. And I'm just wondering how deep the water is. Is it all more than when you get out 12 miles from the mouth of the Columbia, what are you talking?
Yes, so first of all, the 30-fathom curve is an ever-moving target because of sedimentation, et cetera. But the compulsory pilotage area is very close to what the 30-fathom curve used to be. There's not much of a change other than it's done by latitude and longitude. And so within deeper water, out of necessity, we have to board in deeper water. The conditions are better. It's less influence of the river. The swells are not as sharp, they're less, so out of safety, we need to board in deeper water.
Well, thank you. I was curious. This is intended, as I understand it, all three are intended to apply to those folks that are going to be leaving or entering these ports, not for traffic going parallel to the ports.
Correct.
So is it common then for those who are moving up and down the coast to stay further out than 12 miles?
Yes, that's correct.
How far out do they stay?
Generally, almost 50 miles out when they're on the north-south transit line.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. When we say a licensee for that ground in your document, help me put that into dumb kids' language.
That's a licensed pilot.
Oh,
state licensed pilot.
When we say for that ground, you just mean for that area of for that kind of territory?
Yeah, well,
specific. Yeah.
Yes.
Great. And so,
thanks, Mr. Chair. I had a question of whether this expands or shrinks the pilot required area, and you're saying it keeps it the same?
Correct. The compulsory pilotage area is the same.
Okay. Thanks.
Other questions? I don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you.
There isn't anyone else who has signed up to testify on Senate Bill 147. Is there anyone who would like to? There's some suggestions being made in the audience. Let's see, I think I know everyone's name now who's sitting in the audience, who could call you all up. No one's rushing forward, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 147. We'll bring that back, I think, soon with the maps that we can review, and I hope we can move that forward quickly on its return. Is there anything else to come before the committee today? I think we've exhausted our agenda with 50 minutes to spare.
Keep, what are we doing on
that on our tab
on Friday?
What is on our agenda?
Do it now.
Friday. We have five Senate bills up on Friday.
Okay. A series of bills. Unfortunately, given the
series of bills.
That's
given the
unusual.
Is it?
Usually, it's a litany.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
A fathom.
On Friday, I will not be able to be with the committee for the whole meeting because I'm leaving for a Ways and Means hearing. Okay.
That's me, too. I'm leaving for Victoria, British Columbia.
I didn't know that the Ways and Means Committee was having hearings in Victoria, British Columbia.
That's ridiculous. I might change my...
We've got a new district up there.
I may go to this one instead.
That might be interesting. Blumenauer's new district. I think I'm losing control. I better adjourn the committee before we lose any more. And we'll, just to make clear, we're going to carry over Senate Bill 130, and I think... So we're carrying over Senate Bill 130. Committee's adjourned. Thanks.